order. We're going to go a tiny bit out of order for the moment. We lost one of our colleagues in the lobby this last week. He died of a lung infection. His name is Bill Linden, and his funeral is starting just now. So a number of us know him in the room, and I would like to just ask for a brief moment of silence for Bill Linden. Thank you. We will start today. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Judiciary. We will start today with a public hearing on Senate Bill 83.
Can I introduce these?
Pardon?
Can you introduce those?
Oh, I didn't see them. I'll do it after this one. Okay, Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 83 modifies the terminology that is used in Oregon statutes for persons with disabilities. It is the subject of Legislative Council's compliance with House Bill 3047, which was enacted last year, which requested that Legislative Council prepare legislation that begins the process of using the term persons with disabilities in the Oregon revised statutes in lieu of the term disabled persons.
All right. We have signed up Judy Cuneo and Cindy Helvington, who would like to speak together. If there's any way we can provide additional assistance, please let us know.
I'm going to start first, where she can get hers.
If you could identify yourself for the record, that would be great.
My name's Cindy Helvington. I live in Springfield, Oregon, in the 77th District. I'm the executive director for South Advocates as Leaders. I'm here to talk to you about SB 83. Last session, South Advocates from Oregon supported the HB 3047 to make Oregon law and rules use people first language. And with the packets I just gave you. They had last session speech from stories from other people. And in the back there's an article about people first language. Respectful language is very important to people with disabilities. It is important that we recognize people first and not their disability. And as a person with a disability, I want to know by my name and not my disability. At my ability and not the label as disability. We want to thank everyone for doing this work, and please pass SB 83 and make this, all these changes in the language, really part of the law. Thank you for listening to me.
And thank you for coming. Are there questions or comments from the committee? Thank you very much for coming.
My name is Judy
Cleveland.
I'm the South Advocate
coordinator
for the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. Because of my speech, I have brought my communication computer.
Madam Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Judy Tudio, and I am here on behalf of the Council on Developmental Disabilities. First of all, I would like to thank everyone for all of the hard work on Senate Bill 83, the Respectful Language Bill. It means so much to all people with disabilities. I have been involved in self-advocacy off and on for over 30 years, and for the last 10 years I have been it full time. This Respectful Language Bill will make it so that people are known for who they are and not their disability. Words do have an impact, and some of the words that are said about people with disabilities are very hurtful. All we are asking for is to be known for who we are. Thank you for your time.
And thank you for your time bringing this to us. This looks like a really good bill to me. Mm. Are there questions? Did you have anything you wanted to add?
I can't even say enough. About how words impact our lives.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Chair, I want to thank them both as well, and Ms. Hellington, especially from Springfield, which is the other side of my community.
Appreciate that. We have Cindy Hunt from Legislative Council signed up.
Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here before you as the office's representative on Senate Bill 83. I have a couple of handouts for the committee, the first of which is a copy of the bill from last session that you passed, House Bill 3047, that I think the prior testimony talked about. That bill directed our office to begin the process of changing the terminology to persons with disabilities from disabled person. The bill actually told us to begin the process. We began it and finished it. Due to the efforts of a couple of copy editors and a staff attorney that spent hundreds of hours creating Senate Bill 83, which is before you. We searched through the statutes, examined them, made sure that every statute that was out there that had the older language was changed. The other handout that I have before you is our guidelines that we used in doing the bill. Chair Burdick, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. And these guidelines specify exactly the kinds of language that we found in certain parts of the statute that we then changed. For example, in the statutes we now use person with a physical disability, not a crippled person. Person with tuberculosis as opposed to an afflicted person, and it goes on from there. These guidelines are also the guidelines that we're using this session when we draft new legislation and have been distributed to all the attorneys and copy editors in our office to follow. The kinds of bills and statutes that we didn't change were ones that we had to mirror the federal law. There were some instances, or ones that dealt with interstate compacts that other states had passed exact language. We didn't feel that we could change those. But with that, unless there's any questions, that concludes my testimony.
Well, this was a gargantuan effort, and I really commend you and the diligent people who are working behind the scenes to get this all done instead of just a piece of it done. I think the operative word here that I've heard in the testimony is that words indeed can hurt. And as I look at the changes that you've made, there's no question that this is a less hurtful, this will make the Oregon revised statutes less hurtful than they were before, and that's got to be a constructive change. Are there questions from the committee on the bill?
Senator Walker. Yeah, Madam Chair. Ms. Hunt, some of these must have gone way back in our history, because I don't think we've used the words crippled person in an awfully long time, but I could be wrong. It's just really nice that we've actually cleaned up our statutes
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, we were a little surprised, too, when we started doing searches and they came across some of these statutes that haven't been amended probably in 50 years. Mm-hmm. And so our copy editors really started doing a lot of electronic searches when they came across things like that. Then they searched for those words and came, and the bill just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger because as we found these additional statutes, and that's why we have 350 sections. So I think we caught all of them at this point, and you shouldn't find that language in the statutes anymore.
You mentioned one person in particular who put extraordinary effort into that. Who was that?
Chair Burdick, actually there was three of them. There's two of our copy editors, Alicia Meyer and Mike Stock, and then one of our staff attorneys, Marianne Milligan, and they literally spent hundreds of hours on this. This is how they spent their summer vacation, so to speak.
Well, I'm very happy you were able to get their names on the record.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a monstrous piece of work, obviously. I guess just the question, when we go from person with a disability to persons with disabilities, since they're both plural, it still could apply to a person with a single disability, I'm assuming.
Correct, right. Chair Burdick. Senator Cruz, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Good to take care of the grammar questions as well. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Committee, I'm going to close this hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 83.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I move Senate Bill 83 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 83 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Is there anybody who would particularly like to carry this?
I'll be glad to.
Senator Przanski will carry this. Okay, now we're going to go briefly into a work session for purpose of bill introduction. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move LC 1738, LC 1590, and LC 89 all be introduced as committee bills.
Senator Beyer has moved LC 1844, LC 1738, LC 1590, and LC 89 be introduced as Judiciary Committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you. Now we will move back into public hearing, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 84. Council.
That's my favorite bill of the session, every session.
Stop it. Thank you, Chair Burdick. Senate Bill 84 is what is known as a, quote, revisers bill. It seeks to correct grammar and other punctuation errors in Oregon law.
Okay, we have on this modest little bill, Doug McKean signed up from Legislative Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug McKean. I'm a senior deputy legislative counsel. I very happily inherited this job from Virginia Vanderbilt, who did it for a number of years for the Office of Legislative Counsel. She retired. And I believe in what this bill does, which is to correct erroneous material in ORS. We do it every session. What happens is, just all the time, the lawyers and the copy editors in the Legislative Council note problems that they see in statutes. And we write down those problems on our infamous pink sheets that look like these. The statute 173-160 gives Legislative Council very limited authority to do some editorial work on the statutes. They allow us to correct things like capitalization and manifest clerical, grammatical, and typographical errors. And we can do that just by ourselves. We call that those master copy corrections. Anything that goes beyond those manifest clerical, grammatical, and typographical type errors, we write down on these pink sheets. Some of them are substantive enough that we have to build them into bills when we see an opportunity. But then also every 2 years, we do the revisers bill. in the very first section of this year's revisers bill that amends ORS 174-535, sets out the policy for the revisers bill, and it's there to periodically try to maintain accuracy within the Oregon revised statutes. So Senate Bill 84 and its 200 and some sections are statutes that we think can benefit from some clarification or some correction of some erroneous material in those sections. These are all amendments that we find are not substantive, but they go beyond the kinds of editorial things that we can do in LC without a bill. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Okay, questions from the committee? I had one question on the Scrivener's bill last session, Senate bill, I can't remember what the number was the last time. There was a change made in section 166 that later caused a sheriff to have to reinstate a concealed handgun license that had been revoked. And the court found that in the Scrivener's bill, the authority to revoke it had been removed. Could you comment on that? I think you're familiar with that case.
Just a little bit. And actually, I'd like to invite Dave Hendricks up. He and Virginia worked on a response to that court decision, so he can give you more information.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Hendricks.
Chair Verdick, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, special counsel to legislative counsel. That was actually the 2003 revisers bill where there was a change made in the concealed weapon laws, and it was a non-substantive change. The Court of Appeals latched onto the language and found that one of the grounds for revoking a concealed weapon permit had been eliminated by reason of that provision in the 2003 reviser bill. I wrote an opinion in December of 2006 laying forth three very cogent and, in my opinion, very convincing and correct reasons why the court was wrong in finding that. It was a non-substantive change, and it should have been found to be that way, but the court, for whatever reason, failed to apply the rules it itself has adopted for construing statutory language and found that it had this substantive effect. That case was appealed to the Supreme Court. The case's name was Bates v. Gordon. It was appealed to the Supreme Court, and it lingered up there for a long time because of a issue that the court was deciding relating to, I believe it was relating to whether or not cases, what the rules would be for deciding when a case was moot. And indeed, it got sent back down to the Court of Appeals, which is where I believe it's still sitting on determining whether or not it should ever have been decided by the Court of Appeals in the first instance. Be that as it may, we have prepared a draft at the request of Interim Judiciary Committee, House Bill 2300, which would make it absolutely clear as to what the intent was. As Doug has indicated already, the bill is non-substantive. We strive mightily not to make any substantive changes, but just to do these corrections. We have a provision that we amend in every bill that says these are supposed to be non-substantive. The title of the bill is relating to erroneous matter in the ORS, and frankly, the Court of Appeals, if they thought we had done something substantive in the 2003 bill, should have declared that section to be void as being outside the scope of the title, something you members know well about since we tell you about that rule often enough. And for whatever reason, they got in what our opinion was the wrong result. And obviously, we're trying, you know, I think Virginia tried even extra hard, and Doug as well, to make sure there was just no chance that we had an effect in there that was unintended.
Okay. Thank you for putting that on the record. Are there questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, I just love this bill every session. it's kind of fascinating. I haven't found anything exciting in it yet. There was something about prostitution in it last last session that was kind of interesting. But I'll find something interesting to share with people on the floor as to why they should read their bills.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, it's not too surprising that the ones where we find problems are frequently the very old statutes. So sometimes the bill can be a very interesting trip through statutes that were enacted in, like, 1880.
Yeah.
And as I say, you know, sometimes they do have the smell of horses and buggy whips about some of these statutes. And
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? I'm going to give Senator Walker a little bit more time to peruse this bill and others in the building. I think this is quite a monumental effort every session, and I think the more eyes on it, the better. So we will delay having a work session on this, and we'll close the public hearing. Okay, now our next bill, Senate Bill 112. Open a public hearing on 112. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 112 allows a party in a criminal case, the state or a defendant, to serve a subpoena on a foreign or domestic corporation or a limited partnership for documents, records, or other tangible things in a manner described in the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure for serving a summons on a corporation or limited partnership.
We have Michael Slauson and Tim Sylvester signed up on this.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Tim Sylvester from Department of Justice and the Appellate Division. And that is Michael Slauson in the Criminal Justice Division.
Got your well-known, well-worn criminal code in front of you, please.
Yes.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, this is Michael Slauson from the Department of Justice, as Mr. Sylvester just mentioned. What this bill does, in particular, changes the law basically in three significant ways, or not really three changes to the law, but it makes three changes to current law. One sort of significant change, which is to bring in the ability for criminal litigants to subpoena corporations and limited partnerships as civil attorneys can do as for summons. And so what it does is, if we, by adding this amendment, what happens is criminal litigants can serve a corporation or limited partnership by serving a subpoena on a registered agent or the business if it's in the county in which the district attorney's office is or where the litigants are. If not, what the district attorney's office can do, or a criminal defense attorney could do, is to serve the subpoena by mail to a registered agent in the state. What it does, and which probably the most significant change, is what it would allow us to serve a subpoena to out-of-state corporations that otherwise don't have a representative in the state. There are limitations, constitutional limitations, on Oregon's ability to serve out-of-state corporations. There has to be some minimal contacts with the state, as the courts have held that it be fair to subject a particular corporation to Oregon's jurisdiction. But that is a pretty well-developed area of the law as far as what minimal contacts are necessary to subject some out-of-state corporation to Oregon's jurisdiction. So in a nutshell, what this law kind of does is to codify what is already sort of agreement that a lot of district attorney's offices have reached with corporations. Many of them are extremely cooperative in our investigations and allow us to serve a subpoena in state by maybe even a fax. In other words, they're willing to waive personal service that otherwise is required under Oregon law. The only other way to serve a subpoena to an out-of-state corporation under Oregon law is there's a relatively cumbersome process which requires getting a court order in the jurisdiction where, say, for instance, the DA's office is, and sending that court order out to another court, out-of-state court, and then that court issue a subsequent order requiring somebody to appear in our state in that particular jurisdiction. Where this comes up most often, the type of investigations this is going to come up most often is a child exploitation investigations and financial investigations. And I'll just give the committee, with indulgence, a brief example of where it might come up. Say, for instance, law enforcement is contacted by a concerned parent who has a copies of some emails from somebody with a particular screen name, and goes to law enforcement and says, I don't know who this is, but this person's been emailing my underage child and making some, what we kind of refer to as enticing them to engage in some sort of sexual contact. Well, from law enforcement, we have to figure out who that person is, and how we do that is to subpoena those records from a corporation, and normally the internet service providers, to figure out exactly who's been emailing this child. Most often, I'll tell you that the corporations are very cooperative and allow us, as I mentioned before, to serve these by fax. But there are some out-of-state corporations at times otherwise would have the constitutionally required contacts with the state that may not be so cooperative. And what this particular bill will do is to codify those agreements and basically apply them to everybody so that we have some way of compelling them to produce those records and those types of investigations. That's my testimony for purposes of Senate Bill 112 as currently written. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. We also do have some proposed amendment or a proposed amendment.
Pardon, what did you say about
that? We do have a proposed amendment to the statute that I could cover.
Okay, please cover the amendment. I don't see anything in front of me. Maybe I'm missing.
I included it as part of the written testimony.
So you don't have anything drafted yet?
We do not.
Okay, why don't you describe the...
Okay, what this proposal would do is to do something similar that we're talking about with subpoenas for search warrants. Under current Oregon law, except for one exception, which I'll mention, the police officer is required to execute a search warrant. That's a statutory requirement, and as far as I know, not a constitutional requirement. The only ruling I'm aware of dealing with it on a Fourth Amendment law, dealing with whether or not it's a constitutional requirement under federal law, came out of the Eighth Circuit, and they found having an officer present to serve a search warrant is not a constitutional requirement. So in our current statute, we require a police officer to be present to execute a search warrant. We don't require that for bank records, for financial institutions, when we want bank records. And the reason for that, I think, just is a sort of practical idea, is that a police officer is not in the best position, as opposed to a bank, to serve a search warrant. That typically what happens is law enforcement asks the bank employees to actually go ahead and look for the records. So what this amendment does is sort of mirror that type of language for corporations and businesses, and it would be permissive. In other words, it would give law enforcement the opportunity to serve a search warrant as you would a subpoena, as opposed to make it compelled, because we might have some instances when the corporation itself is under investigation. We want to be able to execute the search warrant. But what it does then is it allows us to serve a search warrant and have the business itself go and get the records when they're cooperative. And that makes sense, for instance, if we're again talking about child exploitation cases, and trying to get the records of, say, for instance, Yahoo, and trying to look at their servers to figure out maybe if we need contents of certain emails when search warrants are required, that certainly Yahoo's in a better position than a law enforcement officer to look over the servers and find out where those records are. It does nothing to change any of the substantive requirements for a search warrant. The only thing that it would change is the manner in which a search warrant is required to be served.
So this is, I understand your language here, it's broader actually than internet service providers, but it would include, or is it limited to internet service providers?
Chair Burdick, that's correct, and its current language is broader than internet service providers. Most often it comes up when dealing with internet service providers, but the kind of following the language that we have in the bank records law with financial institutions is it doesn't make sense sometimes to require a police officer to actually execute the search warrant. It makes much more sense to sort of be able to hand that over to the corporation and say, can you go find these records?
Well, I guess my question is, if it makes sense to write it so broadly, why wasn't it written broadly before when it was extended to financial institutions?
Chair Burdick, I don't know why at the time they had financial institutions, why they did that. That's a particular part of the code dealing with bank records, and I think that was probably at the time, and this is sort of a guess, but that's probably only it was before the legislature at that time is just dealing with specifically with bank records. I could also say that I'm not sure off the top of my head exactly when that law was enacted, but this is a growing area of law enforcement, this need for these types of records, especially in child exploitation cases and dealing with cases identity theft, and you're trying to get records from out-of-state businesses. And so the need at the time might not have been there also at the time that that bill was passed as it is now.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pazanski.
I would agree with that. I mean, that my law enforcement, the people I deal with, we're just seeing on the rise of needing to have these type of instruments to be able to get to people that are out of state. We're dealing with a lot with subpoenas, and in most cases they're willing to accommodate us. But I think that's the reason is that this is a growing area where we're seeing, unfortunately, the need to have those records. And as compared to the bank records being something that we as a society have dealt with in a much longer period of time than we have on internet records.
Well, that's the truth.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Just technical question, I guess. I'm wondering if search warrants fit under a relating clause that says relating to subpoenas.
Where'd legislative counsel go?
That's a fairly narrow relating clause.
That's actually a good question. We will ask counsel to check in on that. We are not going to move this bill today because the amendment, so we'll ask counsel to check in on that. Okay. Anything else to add? Any other questions?
I have nothing to add.
Okay. Thank you. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 112. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 233. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Senate Bill 233 allows the State Accident Insurance Fund to contract with the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to provide claim management services for claims that are filed by prisoners for injuries suffered during authorized work or occupational training.
Okay, we have David Hartwig signed up. I assume you're from Safe Corporation. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is David Hartwig. I'm administrator of the State Services Division within the Department of Administrative Services. We have a very brief language proposal for the statute. We think it's a housekeeping matter. You've probably heard that before. But this would clarify language that would permit the State Accident Insurance Fund to contract with Department of Administrative Services to administer the inmate injury claims that occur while inmates are doing work. This would affirm the practice that's been in place since 1991, and it's worked very well for the Department of Administrative Services. We have a good working relationship with SAFE and their claims units that is dedicated to do this work, and we would recommend your consideration of the language change.
Okay. Questions from the committee?
This one, Madam Chair. Thank you. You've been doing this since 1991. What is it that you're asking us to do differently now? You just want it in statute? You've
Chair
just been
Burdick,
doing it without direction. Is that the deal?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, we're here today because of a contract renewal review process that occurred in 2005. It was the question was raised that the language didn't specifically authorize SAFE to do that contract work for the Department of Administrative Services for these type claims. And so this language that's proposed at the end of the bill would clarify that SAFE does have the authority to administer these claims for Department of Administrative Services.
And I have another question.
Please follow up, Senator Walker.
Thank you. Just one other question. I mean, it seems reasonable to me that SAFE, being a state agency, sort of, would be administering the claims of another state agency. So, but was this ever required to go out to bid and SAFE won the bid? Or, I mean, because there are other workers' comp carriers in the state. I'm just kind of curious.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, to my understanding, in 1991, when this activity was initiated and it was initially overseen by Department of Justice, that it was perceived as being workers' comp-like in the types of injuries.
Okay.
And so it seemed to make sense that the administration of the claims would fit with SAFE. So I believe initially that's how it was started. And then in 1995, the program was transferred from Department of Justice to Department of Administrative Services. And we continued the same working relationship with SAFE that had been started in 1991.
All right, thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much. You're the only person signed up. Is there anybody else who wanted to speak to this? Are you okay with this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 233 and open a work session on Senate Bill 233. Senator Breyer, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 233 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Breyer has moved Senate Bill 233 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Senator Cruz, would you like to carry this?
Love to.
Perfect. Okay. Now we have Senate Bill 257, on which we will open a public hearing. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 257 amends the definition of securities under the Oregon Securities Law to include variable annuities.
Okay, we have several people signed up. We have, first of all, Scott Shore and Bob Banks, who look like they want to testify together. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pleasure to be here. Members of the committee, thank you. My name is Robert Banks. I'm a securities lawyer from Portland, and I'm here to testify in favor of the bill. As Oregon law now stands, variable annuities are exempt from the definition of securities. But in fact, they are securities. Under federal law, under the Federal Securities Act, they are securities, and now there are 17 states that have amended their securities laws to include variable annuities as securities. And the simple fact is that when people purchase these products, they buy them as investments. I don't know if you have had any experience with them, but what you buy is one or more mutual funds, and with that fund kind of comes in a package. You get certain insurance benefits as well. There's typically a death benefit, and you can buy additional riders that have other traditional insurance benefits in them. But more than 90% of the money that you spend on that product goes into the mutual funds, into the investment aspect of the product. And they're sold not as insurance products but as investments. The problem with these products is that they have been one of the biggest areas of abuse in the nation, and I have submitted some testimony about it. What I have cited for you is, first of all, some information from the SEC's website. The SEC has only singled out three areas of investment abuse right now to put onto its website, and one of those three is variable annuities, and that's on there right next to oil and gas scams. The NASD also has a full page on its website warning investors about variable annuities. And variable annuities aren't inherently evil, but they are products that are being sold so heavily because they have some of the highest commission rates of any investment product that you can buy. They're typically 5% or more commission to the salesperson. And they're also very complicated products that very few investors really understand what they're buying when they buy them. They are sold as products that have tax benefits, and there is a tax benefit to them because, as if your variable annuity increases in value, you don't have to pay money on the increase until there's a distribution. But the problem is that many of them are sold to seniors or people, even non-seniors, and they're sold into IRA accounts. And IRA accounts already have that tax advantage, and so you're really not getting the benefit of what you're paying for. Another problem with them is that they are set up to be long-term investments, and many of them are being marketed to seniors. And the issue there is that if you sell these products, if you decide you need to sell them or part of them, within the first 6 years, you have to pay a penalty that steps down each year. It's typically 6% if you need to liquidate that the first year, 5% the next, and so on. And so if you're 80 years old and you buy this and you need the money at 81 or 82 for some health problems, you're going to have to pay a significant part of your investment just to get out of it and to get your money back. Those are just a couple of the examples of problems that the federal regulators have seen in looking at these investments. They are regulated in the state of Oregon by the federal regulators. The feds are permitted to regulate them here. But the problem is the SEC and the NASD, of course, only take the very biggest of cases, and their presence in Oregon in regulating variable annuities is, I don't know it for certain, but I would guess it's minimal if it exists at all. They are regulated at the state level by the insurance division right now, and the insurance division does have some regulations that apply to the sale of variable annuities, but they look at them from an insurance perspective, not from an investment perspective. And so they look to see if they are appropriate as insurance, but they don't look at them to see if they are appropriate as investments. And the reason I'm in favor of the bill is because if they are termed securities, then the regulations under Oregon law that apply to investments would apply to them, and they would have to look at things like the investor's investment objectives, what their risk tolerance levels are, did they really understand the product, and they would, and the state would then have the authority to regulate people who sell these things as securities using those types of analyses. The other thing, under Oregon law, if they are securities, they would be also subject to the regulations that require that there be supervision of these products so that somebody doesn't get tempted to sell to an 80-year-old a variable annuity product that's really set up to be a 10-year investment, because under the securities laws, you've got to have a supervisory system in place so that somebody supervises every salesperson and makes sure that the sale that's being made is suitable or appropriate to the investor. That doesn't currently exist as variable annuities are being marketed in Oregon now, and I think it would be a beneficial change.
Thank you. Do you know how other states do this?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair?
What other states do?
I've listed some of them for you in my testimony. Washington is one of them. Arizona, North and South Dakota, Hawaii.
Oh, got it. Here, it's right
Vermont.
On the first page of your testimony. And these are the states that regulate the securities. Okay.
That's correct, ma'am.
Got it. Okay, and can I assume that the rest of them regulate them in the insurance arena?
I think that's probably true, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Chair Burdick, my name is Scott Shore. I'm with the law firm of Stolz-Toll, Bernlachty & Schlachterett. I'm a Portland citizen. We often represent investors, but occasionally brokers and corporations as well. I just wanted to add quickly to a few things. I think under the Uniform Securities Act, which is being proposed in many states, the definition of security does include variable annuity. So I think we're likely to see more states, and I'd say it's fair to say there's a trend towards including variable annuities as securities. I'd echo all the comments Mr. Banks made. I brought with me, just as an addition, some testimony of a former client, the Sivers Companies. They are a small development company in Portland, Oregon, very sophisticated people, and they ran their company's IRA, and a broker came to them to sell variable annuities, as Mr. Banks mentioned, an already tax-deferred investment, and this broker sold them these variable annuities into their tax-deferred accounts, and these were very sophisticated people who did not understand the aspects, and they didn't even realize that this was, in part, an insurance product and didn't really want insurance. Finally, I was the original proponent of the bill, and when we discussed it with the Legislative Council, we made changes to the securities laws. There does need to be, apparently, an amendment to the insurance code that we don't have before you yet, but under the insurance code, as I read it, any policy that's been approved by the Department of Consumer and Business Services is exempt from the securities laws. So I think there needs to be a little carve-out for variable annuities from the insurance code, and I've had some discussions with the DCBS to make sure that the language works and doesn't mess up any other regulatory scheme, but there does need to be that minor amendment. Unfortunately, we don't have it yet before you, but we're working on that.
But we aren't going to move the bill anyway, so thank you.
Chair Bitter, can I add one other thing I forgot to mention? In the event that there's any concern that, well, we're just lawyers here and securities lawyers looking to create additional claims for relief or causes of action for citizens, that really isn't the case. We as private lawyers can bring claims for variable annuities abuses right now under the common laws of negligence and breach of fiduciary duty is how they're usually brought. And because there are federal regulations that are in place, those regulations really set the standard for what the conduct is. And if this bill or some version of it were to pass, the standard wouldn't change at all. It would just be that it would be applicable in the state as well. The real purpose for it is to allow the state to investigate these cases. And the problem is that a lot of them involve losses for older people that are pretty small amounts of money on a litigation scale, because say they have to pay back 6% of what they invested, and maybe they invested $100,000. It's not right that they should have to pay that amount back, but it's pretty difficult to justify filing an arbitration or a lawsuit over it.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, Senator Cruz?
Yeah, how big of a problem is this currently?
Well, it's among the federal regulators that I have spoken with, Senator Cruz, I would say that it's probably certainly in the top five investment abuse products in the nation.
I guess, Madam Chair, I mean, how many cases in the last year in the state of Oregon?
In private cases?
Yeah.
There's no way to really track that, Senator, because most of the cases are brought in arbitration through the NASD, and they don't maintain those statistics. I did cite in my testimony a statement by the NASD from 2004 that says variable annuities have been the focus of increased NASD-wide attention for the last 2 years and subject to more than 80 disciplinary actions from the years 2002 to 2004. And the SEC in 2002 said that there was a 45% increase in complaints about variable annuities. That's also in my testimony on page 2.
Madam Chair, so that 80, that's nationwide?
That's nationwide, sir.
Our counsel has a question.
Thank you. Are there any benefits to be able to bring a private cause of action under the securities law versus these common law actions you've talked about?
The only benefit that I can see, counsel, is that under the securities law, there would be a discretionary right to attorney fees. The fact finder could, the decision maker could award attorney fees to the prevailing party. The thing is that almost all these cases have to be brought in NASD arbitration, and attorney fees are virtually never awarded in that forum.
Chair Burdick, just to add to that, I think one other minor difference that may play out in different cases is that under the Oregon securities laws, you also have a right to rescission, which means you get to return the investment to whoever sold it to you for 100% of your damages. The damages under common law in certain cases may or may not be different. But
how would they differ?
Well, it may be you'd be able to recover a percentage of your loss, but not all of your loss in your common law. Under a rescission or a damage, you're going to be able to return your entire investment and perhaps get interest under the statutory interest rate.
So if they were regulated as a security, you could get this rescissionary
On the private side of damages. I'm not sure. I imagine it's for the state as well, but certainly under the private side.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Corey Streisinger and David Tatmer from Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is David Tatman, the Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today to offer comments on Senate Bill 257. And as you've heard from the proponents of the bill, this bill would add variable annuities to the definition of securities under Oregon law. Currently, variable annuities are considered an insurance product under Oregon law, and our department regulates both securities and insurance, so we thought it would be useful to come in and talk a little about how the two regulatory schemes are similar, how they are different, and what this bill would mean to us from an enforcement standpoint. And as you've heard, variable annuities have characteristics of both securities and insurance. Sometimes they're referred to as a mutual fund in an insurance wrapper. So from our perspective, consumers purchasing variable annuities do, in fact, purchase them as investments rather than as a traditional insurance-type policy. And we do have concerns about some of the sales practices and the way that they are sold. And for that reason, under the insurance side of our business, we did put in place suitability rules a couple of years ago. They went into place in early 2005. There's for a long time, suitability rules have been in place in the securities side. That is, someone selling a security is required to ensure that the product is not unsuitable for the purchaser in light of their investment objectives, their age, their financial condition, and so on. And we did put in place a parallel set of rules for variable annuities using our insurance regulatory power in 2005 because of the concerns that we had about some of the sales practices. And we did see instances, for example, of a variable annuity being sold to an elderly person when the payback period would be inconsistent with their needs at that age. Or also, as was mentioned previously, the sale of a variable annuity inside an IRA where the tax benefit is duplicative of the tax benefit already existing. In terms of how the regulatory schemes parallel and what differences this bill would make, first of all, product approval. Actually, product approval, we currently do more on the insurance side than on the security side for this type of product because the securities product approval, that is the approval of the mutual fund aspect of the product, is done at the federal level. And even if these were classified as securities, because of that federal review, we would not do a review at the state level. We do, however, at the state level, do product approval, product review on the insurance side, the insurance aspects of the product. So our powers there on the insurance side are actually stronger, but would remain under this bill. That is, this bill would not take away the application of those insurance requirements.
So you'd have, pardon me for interrupting, you'd have this type of financial vehicle regulated in two departments within your organization?
Madam Chair, we are one department. We would have two sets of tools within the single department. And what we try to do is to ensure that we don't have two separate regulatory approaches to these sort of overlapping areas. That is, it's our job to put our staff to work to address these products in a complementary way that doesn't have different layered sets of regulations. So we are, in fact, looking at this internally as to how we would put together, if this bill were to pass, a team that would look at these products in a unified way. One example, for example, is we would not expect to have two filings and two fees. We would look for a waiver of a fee on the security side because the product is already being filed with us on the insurance side. So one point I, in fact, want to make is if this bill were to pass, we would look at making it one regulatory program, not two, but we would have the tools available to us statutorily under both programs. So the second set of issues, then, is that suitability rule. And as I mentioned, we do have suitability rules on the security side and on the insurance side today. And I heard some concerns mentioned by the prior witness about whether they were equally as effective, and those are issues we can certainly look at whether or not the bill passes. Our goal is to have a consistent suitability standard that's appropriate for these products, regardless of whether they're considered securities or insurance or both. The third one is the sales force, and today these products, variable annuities, must be sold by broker-dealers who sell securities. But in this area, actually, we do have what we view as somewhat of a regulatory gap, because for securities, broker-dealers are required to be supervised in their sale of securities products, and we have the ability to enforce those supervisory responsibilities. We do not have that ability with respect to insurance products, even though those insurance products, in this case, are being sold by those same broker-dealers. So we actually think it would be more effective, and one of the things we would get if this bill were to pass, to enable us to oversee the supervisory responsibilities of those who supervise broker-dealers with respect to these variable annuity products, just as we today have it with securities products. The final area I wanted to touch on just briefly is enforcement tools. We have the ability to enforce laws, to investigate, to issue cease and desist orders, both under securities laws and under insurance laws, but there are a few differences. We do have the ability to seek higher penalties on the security side than on the insurance side. And through the civil actions, we do have the ability to obtain restitution on the security side, but not on the insurance side. So from our perspective, those would be useful tools to have for these variable annuity products because, as I said, they mostly people purchasing variable annuities do so as an investment vehicle, and there doesn't seem to be any good reason to us why those parallel tools should not be available. So for that reason, we do support the concept behind Senate Bill 257. As was pointed out, we believe an amendment would be needed in order to make the bill effective if that's the committee's choice. And that is because, as was noted, in ORS 731.046, there's a parallel provision stating that if a product is approved as an insurance product, it is not subject to securities regulation. So both David and I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
I'd like you to address Senator Cruz's question of the earlier witness, which is, you know, how are you seeing this problem on the ground that this bill would address?
David?
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz,
would you identify?
I'm sorry, David Tatman, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And within that division, we regulate a multitude of financial institutions, including the securities salespeople. We go out and routinely conduct examinations of broker-dealers, and those are the people who sell the securities, and investment advisors who also advise people about purchasing securities. At this time, because a variable annuity is not a security product, we may note where we will see a complaint or we will see a problem, but we don't have authority to take any action. So I have no firm numbers to give you to say we've taken this many actions or we've seen this many violations. Anecdotally, though, we see this problem come up a great deal, particularly among the elderly. There's a disproportionate number of elderly people who are sold these products, mostly in part, I believe, because of their close relationship to their insurance agents, but they disproportionately are the ones who file complaints that either we receive or we see when we go in and conduct an examination. But I have no firm numbers in terms of the number that are either sold in Oregon or the numbers that are sold in violation of the law.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? All right. Thank you. Okay. Now we'll have John Mangan and Todd Thacker. Sorry, John.
All right. Happens all the time.
No, it doesn't. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mangan. I'm Regional Vice President of the American Council of Life Insurers. And the ACLI is a national trade association of life insurers that currently accounts for about 94% of all the life insurance and annuity premiums in Oregon and in the United States. We have about 300 companies that are licensed in Oregon. Among those, our largest domestic company, which is Standard Insurance Company of Portland. We also have regional companies like State Farm, Farmers, Liberty Mutual, Symetra, and others that have major presence here. Today we're rising to respectfully oppose this bill, and we have a number of issues we'd like to raise, and we'd also like to address a few of the comments that have been made so far. I have with me Todd Thacker. He's a vice president of Prudential Insurance Company of America, and in a minute I'll ask him to address some of our national efforts at dealing with some of the problems that Senator Cruz has raised. One of our biggest concerns with this bill is that as an industry we are seeking by working together with our regulators, a system of uniform regulation throughout the states. And we believe a system of uniform regulation is best for consumers, that it lowers prices, that it yields better and more effective regulation, it deals with problem areas more effectively by using best practices, and that uniformity has been a goal of ours with the commissioner for many years. But we believe this bill, in fact, diverts from the uniform standard that's in place in the United States. Most states, in fact 47 states, currently put the primary responsibility for insurance regulation with the insurance regulator. We think that makes sense, just as the banking regulator is the primary regulator of banking. These products, variable annuities, very important to individual retirement in America right now. And they are complex, and that's why there's a significant regulatory system in place. But I want to address one of the key principles that we have with this, and that is an annuity is an insurance product. We heard some testimony that said they're not, that they're securities, and we heard some testimony that maybe they're part insurance. The commissioner rightly said that they, in fact, are a hybrid of both insurance and securities. The Supreme Court has found that, in fact, the securities portion of the product rightfully should be regulated by the federal government through the SEC and through the NASD, the National Association of Securities Dealers, but that the insurance portion, which contains significant insurance features, should be regulated by state insurance commissioners. And that's the system we have today. It's a very significant, complex, three-part system. And we think that this bill adds a fourth layer by taking our insurance products and putting them into another department. We don't see much upside to that. And we see significant confusion and potential downside to that. It would be somewhat akin to the bankers might have a similar reaction if you took a CD product, which looks a little bit like an annuity. It's a fixed term. You get an investment return. There's a surrender penalty if you bring it back too soon. If we were to say that's now an insurance product and we should have the insurance department regulate it, the banks would be nervous about that because there's a very significant set of regulations that we could run afoul of. The fact that, one of the proponents has said that we would have to, in fact, tinker with the insurance code if you go ahead and do this, is a red flag. It means that you're going to have to be balancing two different codes, and we think there's significant cause for confusion there. We also think it will affect our producers, the producers who sell and market our products, and right now who are significantly regulated through the NASD, and we will let them speak, of course, to the system of supervision that's currently in place. But for those reasons, we think this adds potential confusion, potential expense, and makes Oregon an outlier rather than somebody who's trying to work toward uniformity. It certainly will affect, we think, the competitiveness of our companies who compete with banks and securities firms, stock brokerages, in the sale of these products. And we're just not sure that a case has been made that the insurance commissioner hasn't, in fact, done a good job of regulating these products under the current system. The director mentioned that in 2005, the department promulgated a suitability rule, which, by the way, our industry supports a suitability rule for all products nationwide. And during that process, they actually did a study of how many complaints there were in the annuity and life insurance sales arena. And if I recall, this is a couple years ago, but I think there were 11 questionable sales over the course of about 3 years. Now, 11 is too many, but it's not that significant in relation to the thousands and thousands of products sold each year. In America, there are 5 million annuities sold each year, and the NESD has addressed maybe 80 in terms of formal complaints. Not that they're not important, but there is a system to deal with them. I also wanted to...
Did you say the system was again? It's a federal system, right?
It's really a three-part system. The federal side, the security side, is regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission and the National Association of Securities Dealers, which regulates the producers and agents that sell the product throughout the country. So every aspect of marketing and sales of a variable annuity product is regulated by those federal bodies. In addition,
you've got a federal body regulating, we have this in a lot of areas where you'll have both federal and state regulation of something. What would be the problem having the state regulate it using similar criteria?
Chair Burdick, we don't actually have a problem with that. We recognize that there is a federal component, significant federal component of regulation, and then there's a significant state component, just that component really belongs with the insurance regulator, because the underlying product is an insurance product. In fact, many variable products, they look like investments, but many of them have a fixed component as well. So, for instance, you might have two accounts. You might have one that looks like a stock market account, and you might have a secondary account in the product, which is a fixed account. And that is most certainly an insurance product. So by bifurcating this definition, you're going to have cases where the two directors are going to wonder which kind of product it is. And for our people in the field, it's going to be even more confusing.
Well, in your opinion, does the state insurance division currently have the authority to regulate on suitability grounds, for instance, not selling to 80-year-olds, not selling into IRAs? In your opinion, does the insurance division have this power?
Chair Burdick, we believe they do. In fact, in 2005, as the director mentioned, the department promulgated a suitability rule, which is actually arguably broader than any federal rule, because it gives the commissioner wide authority to look at a case and say, and deem it to be unsuitable. And if she finds that to be the case, she has broad powers to deal with that, we believe. So we believe that issue has been addressed and that the results have been satisfactory. So again, we think this is a solution looking for a problem. A couple of other things I did want to mention too, and that is that the
uniform... Hold on before you
sure.
do. Senator Walker has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm seeing conflicting testimony, and so I need to be sort of steered in the right direction or the wrong direction, I guess, depending on what you see, but I need to understand it before you go any further. In the testimony offered by Mr. Banks, he says there are 8 states that have passed legislation to grant state securities divisions the authority to regulate the sale of variable annuities, and you're calling this legislation would make Oregon an outlier. I don't really see how that would you could say that, given there are 8 other states. But probably the most important thing that is a concern to me is Mr. Banks says variable annuities have been considered to be securities under the federal security laws for many years. Yet in your testimony, you say moving variable insurance contracts under the definition of, quote, security would disrupt an already coordinated system of state and federal regulation. So who's right here? Are these things considered securities under federal law, or are they not?
Madam Chair and Senator Walker, I guess I was trying to explain previously that these products are indeed hybrids. The Supreme Court has said they have a securities component, which is definitely regulated by federal authorities, the SEC and the NESD. That's the portion that of this retirement product, for instance, that gets put into the stock market. It's securities. But the underlying product, the Supreme Court said, is an insurance product, and it is currently regulated by the states. Now, there are, we think, actually 9 states that have diverted from that view and included this in the definition. But there are 33 states that haven't done that. The Uniform Securities Act, which is addressing this on a national scope, they actually rejected a proposal to include variable annuities in that definition. Now, it's up to the states to decide, but it's not in the model such that variable products are included. It's not in the model. So we wanted to make that clarification.
Madam Chair, could I ask you to provide us the Supreme Court case so I can
yes.
read it for myself?
I'm happy to get a copy of it. I don't have it with me right now, but I can get it for you.
Thank you.
You done?
I am.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. A couple of things. Of the nine states, I'm assuming, based on the testimony you've already heard and what I believe you're alluding to, that's more recent changes. So, in other words, it could be on the cutting edge. People are now rethinking and relooking. Is that a fair statement?
Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski, certainly the changes have been more recent. Whether that means it's cutting edge or whether this people are out of control, I'm not sure. But
well, let me ask you this then. You said that there's been 80 cases that are out of 5 million. Those are ones that actually have been, why don't you elaborate on what that means? Because I think that number may be not true, showing how many problems have actually been. Because you're telling me what I'm hearing is only 80 cases out of 5 million?
Well, excuse me, Chair Burdick and Senator. I didn't use the 80 figure. I'm not sure where that came from. But what our understanding is that as of 2 years ago, I think it was 0.34% of all variable products sold. That was the complaint ratio that we saw from the SEC. And so that's less than 0.5%.
And does that include the ones that actually went through an arbitration-type process as compared to having some type of formal action before one of the federal agencies?
Senator, I'm not sure about that. The 80 may refer to things that were more formalized.
Thank you.
I can't answer that.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Did you want to add anything?
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Todd Factor with Prudential Financial, and we are one of the largest annuity companies in the country. And we believe that the current system of shared oversight between the Department of Insurance and the SEC and NASD strikes the right balance to oversee the insurance, both the insurance and the security characteristics of these products. Prudential, you know, we take the appropriateness of sales very, very seriously. And as John said, we've been active in working on the national models, the senior annuity protection model, which a chunk of it was adopted by Oregon a couple of years ago. And, you know, we have worked successfully with the Division of Insurance in Oregon to ensure that they do have the tools to effectively oversee annuity sales and protect Oregon consumers. And as John mentioned, and the director too, that they did adopt the broad suitability regulations a couple of years ago. And we believe that if there are more tools that are needed, that it's on the insurance side, and we should continue the current scheme of regulatory oversight because it's been working. It's a good balance between the nature of the product, and it tracks the hybrid nature of the product. So, and as John said, when they were looking at the reg a couple of years ago, there were, I believe, what did you say, 11 or 9 complaints in Oregon. And any complaint is too many, but we believe that actually it shows that the system's working. And at that time, 2 years ago, the division issued a new regulation to enhance their tools to address these issues. As an insurer and a company that's selling these products, we always believe that if there's an inappropriate sale, we are on the line, and we do want to make, and we will, not only will we will make our consumers whole, because obviously that's the right thing to do, and that's just the way that we operate. So I guess if there are legitimate substantive issues that continue to need to be addressed, that we would argue that the appropriate way to do it is within the existing scheme that's out there and has worked for a number of years, as opposed to creating yet another level of bureaucracy and oversight.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just getting back to these cases that we were talking about, and it's possible I'm thinking of different cases. My understanding of the law of variable annuities is that they are regulated by the SEC, and there are cases out there that talk about whether something is or is not a variable annuity. And so if it's a fixed annuity, and there's a test out there, if there's a set rate of return, and I'm sure it's more complicated than that, then it is not a security as defined by the SEC, and therefore it's not regulated under federal law. And so it's not so much, so these cases aren't so much saying that we're not sure whether this variable annuity is, or
part of this variable annuity is regulated by the SEC and part is regulated by someone else, what they were saying is you have to define what the annuity is. And then once you define it, then we know who regulates it. Are we talking about the same cases, or am I thinking of something else?
I'm not sure. I'm happy to provide you with the case that I mentioned and see if it matches up. But this is a complex area, and these products do have multiple features to them. And I think that was our point, is that the commissioner has done a fine job, we think a good job, of determining what that component is and regulating it. And she mentioned all variable contracts are submitted to her for approval, her department. And the federal government has done its job to regulate the security sale. And the producers will tell you, I think, shortly how they are regulated, how deep that regulation goes. But the key is this system of insurance regulation, it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense that insurance, that products that have an insurance component be subject to insurance regulation. That's just, we believe that that's just fundamental. I just want to point out one other thing before we turn this over to the producers, and that is we think there is a drafting error in the bill, which actually it doesn't address variable life insurance. Variable life insurance policies are sold much like variable annuities. This security definition includes the annuities but does not include life insurance, and yet the exclusion, I think it's at the top of page 4, excludes it takes all variable products out of the exclusion. And that's just a long way of saying that we think there's some confusion about life insurance and annuities in this bill. It probably also concern us. But one of the things that that points out is this is so complex that changing a word like that is can be very confusing to us. So with that, we'd be happy to answer anything further.
Questions for me? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we'll move on to our next witnesses, Dave Nelson and Richard Yost.
Madam Chair, I have two others that are listed
up. Why don't you pull up another chair and all four of you come on up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, Oregon Division, formerly known as the Oregon Life Underwriters Association, and after that, the Oregon Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. Now the final iteration we believe to be the Oregon Division of the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. What it just...
Now, I was having an identity crisis.
Any questions? Also, Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me tell you that I also am the, I think, fairly proud owner of four variable life insurance, or four variable annuity policies that provide the fundamental basis of my retirement program, whenever that may come. And I think that, you know, in purchasing those, I think the main thread of our testimony would be, as you will hear from the technical experts on either side of me, is that these are insurance products, and they've been successfully regulated by the insurance division for many, many, many years. And there, as has been described adequately by the previous witnesses, that thread is a composite program or a composite policy that does include a securities element to it. There have been many bells and whistles that have been hung on life insurance products through time, with side funds and all the other kinds of investment tools from the whole life policies of 25 years ago. However, the basic thread is that there is an insured guaranteed element to that says that they're going to pay me for the rest of my life as a part of my retirement program if I annuitize the policy. My other choice is to take the lump sum and run. So basically, it is that insurance feature that is the basis of these programs and why they've always been regulated by the insurance divisions of the states. I think there has been and been discussed the suitability regulations that the department adopted a couple of years ago. And those, I think, adequately ensure that people like me, who are the customers and are fairly dumb in terms of life insurance, are adequately taken care of, and that there is redress to the companies, as there always have been, in making consumers whole. Let me first introduce Mr. Richard Yost, who is a financial advisor from Eugene, and can tell you what he has to deal with in dealing with variable life insurance or variable annuities in the regulation our area.
Okay, and yes. We're running short of time, so if you can keep your comments as brief as possible. Thank you.
I'll speak quickly. Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I'm here as part of the problem.
Your name, please.
Excuse me. Richard Yost, certified financial planner with Fiscal Funding, which is an independently registered advisory firm, primarily representing the interests of business owners and operators. As such, we assist our clients in attaining and maintaining their financial goals and objectives through a network of risk management systems and networks. One of the primary mechanisms that we use to handle risk is insurance products. I have for 32 years been a licensed insurance agent. I'm also an insurance consultant. My agency is also licensed as an insurance agency as well as an RIA. We do not represent a company. We represent our clients. As I say, I'm here as the problem because I do recommend variable annuities. I do recommend variable annuities inside of retirement accounts. I recommend variable annuities to seniors. And I also am a consumer. Now, my purpose today is twofold. First of all, is to express my opposition to the bill, Senate Bill 257. Also to share with your producer's point of view, because what you've heard up here been lawyers, company representatives, etc. Well, I'm here talking for my clients. And obviously, we all understand that there's a need for oversight. So that's not a matter of debate. What we have here is an insurance product with an investment component, but primarily an insurance product. As a result, regulation exists both at the federal level as a security and at the state level as an insurance product. You've already heard that. Now, my concern here is for my ability to provide products and services to my clients to better serve their interests. I do not represent an insurance company. I represent my client. The state has created an agency for the oversight of insurance companies, insurance agencies, and insurance producers. In addition, the ability to oversee rates and forms is clearly a function of the insurance division. The question here is one of access by the consumer of a very specific product on a timely basis given a very fluid market. So I very respectfully encourage the committee to set aside Senate Bill 257 as a solution looking for a problem that does not really exist and in fact could create problems for the consumer, for the producer, for the companies. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
You said that you sell these products inside IRAs and
it
to elderly people. Given the previous testimony, how do you justify selling it to an 80-year-old, for example, when there's a penalty for...
Is the question one of selling it to an 80-year-old or is the question one of putting it inside of a retirement account?
Either one.
Well, let's start with the retirement account. You have a product that's specifically designed for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to provide retirement income. No other product out there can provide a retirement income. Every other product out there has some definite life, whereas an annuity has an unlimited life, just like a pension does. So the only capacity for the consumer to create for him or herself a retirement income is to purchase an annuity. Federal government has regulation on before it right now, trying to look for ways to encourage the consumer to use annuities, which is rather interesting because that seems in opposition to what the regulators are doing. We have a product that has deferral, and it's been mentioned here, what sense does it make to put a tax shelter inside of a tax shelter? I've heard that primarily from stockbrokers for years and years and years. Well, that really is not the question. The question is a reasonable rate of return liquidity, professional management, and diversification. And because of that, a variable annuity provides an excellent vehicle to do that. When the distribution is made, it is taxed as ordinary income. Now, my point is this, is that perhaps what we should be questioning are those who would put into a retirement account those kinds of assets that are subject to capital gains tax, which is much lower than ordinary income, and thereby converting capital gains tax to ordinary income tax. I don't think anybody here would want to do that, but that's exactly what you do when you put a stock or a product that has a gain in it. You're converting a capital gain to an ordinary income tax. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. So when we talk about whether or not a product is suitable for a retirement account, I'd love to have that conversation with anybody. Talking about a suitability, I recall a story. Some of you probably remember Lewis Rukeyser's Wall Street Week. Yeah, you remember the very last appearance of Lewis Rukeyser's father? He was age 93. And Lewis Rukeyser turned to his dad and said, "Pop, where are you putting your money?" Want to guess what his answer was? Annuities. Annuities.
Because?
Well, his reason was because, first of all, it avoided probate. He was guaranteed a return, not only of his principal, he was guaranteed a return on his money. And because of that, he felt that was a very, very good place to put his money, because at age 93, he knew he didn't have a lot of time left, and he wanted to get that to his kids as expeditiously as possible.
Okay. All right. Anybody else from the panel?
Go with Mike.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Mike Mathis. I'm a manager with the Principal Financial Group in Portland, Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, Chair Burke, today. And in the interest of brevity, and just we've heard a lot of things, and I'm certainly in opposition to the Bill 257. And I think from my standpoint, it's a little different than just the producer, but I'm also on the hook for supervisory responsibility. Because, you know, want to maybe share with you, you know, how the sale works. And I know we heard there's suitability now around the sale of these products. So if I'm a customer sitting down with our reps and they're going through the application prospectus and the suitability, once it goes from there, and actually because there's so many parts to the sale these days, our agency staff even gets involved in it, because if we're going to send this back to the home office, we have to have our ducks in a row. And as a supervisory register representative, you know, I have, if something goes wrong in the sale, I can be held for lack of supervision. So I have a definite interest in making sure that these products are suitable as well. Then once the application gets to our home office, it's not only going to just our broker-dealer compliance area, but the insurance compliance area is also reviewing this particular transaction, making sure that it's suitable for our clientele. Then we come in with the state insurance division and the NASD. So those are places where they're looking at our companies, reviewing us on regular annual audits, but we're also open to spot audits, surprise audits as well. So I guess what I'm just trying to say is I think the what we have in place today is enough. And I think obviously I think I heard it said that, you know, one complaint is one complaint too many, but I think our clients have an opportunity to be made whole through the process that we have today.
Okay, so. Thank you. 2 minutes for you, if you would like to speak.
No, the only thing, I'm Bob Buxman. I'm the executive director for NAFA Oregon, which Dave explained the whole process. One of the things I was concerned about when I read 257 was the fact that it includes variable annuities, but does not include variable life insurance. You've also got indexed annuities, products which also could have a component of variability in there. And I think right now, just because there are so many products out there that have variable, both fixed and variable components to them, that to leave them in the same process right now with the insurance division as it currently stands is probably the best way to go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I've been timing. I have 50 seconds of the 2 minutes.
I'm cutting you in half because you've already spoken.
Okay. as a consumer, also as a representative of NAFOR Oregon, I think one of the things that we're at risk in with the, in the insurance industry is a matter of over notification, over disclosure, and overwhelming the consumer with disclosure paperwork. We're now up to where it's about an inch thick. And let me assure you that by the time the consumer gets to page three, they have forgotten what's in page one and have tuned out the next 90 pages of the disclosure document that's before them. So I want you to be very cautious in adding more regulation and more disclosure in the interest of consumer protection.
Well, that's why we have lawyers, Mr. Yes. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. We have Rick Bennett from AARP signed up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. I provided some written testimony, and I won't go over that again. Obviously, AARP thinks this is good legislation. And the only thing I would say, it concerns me a little bit to hear the industry representatives kind of downplaying the investment side and playing up the insurance side. From personal experience, my wife has had a variable annuity for some time, and I know that probably a third or less of her premium goes to the life insurance, which provides her insures her life and has been for a certain amount for as long as she makes a premium and so forth. But two-thirds of the monthly premium she pays goes to the investment side. And there is tremendous risk there, as we've seen in the last few years with investments that we all have. And so I would just suggest with that type of ratio as far as how, where the premium goes, that if you're going to look for oversight, the variable annuity should be considered a security and not an insurance product.
Would your comment extend to variable life insurance as well?
Well, I think, like I said, I think, as I understand it, and as it's already been stated, this is very complex. But again, I think you have life insurance, and like any other life insurance, you pay the premium, and from that moment on, you have a certain death benefit. But on the other side, it is clearly an investment with tremendous risk. And I don't think everyone always clearly understands the risk side of it.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you for coming.
Thanks again.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 257. Any other business from the committee? Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Okay.